Welcome. It's nice to see each one of you. I don't recall when I first thought of the whole notion of sanctuary, but I think it's a long, long time ago, probably even as a child, recognizing that the Christian community and that religious people often do things that are outside the context of law, of the civil law, that what is called for, what religious people often see as called, themselves being called upon, will often contribute to the civil society, and sometimes it will do more than the civil society can do. So I was interested when I first heard Pastor Hergesheimer on CBC speaking about Mikhail Lenikoff and his family and the issue that had arisen in Vancouver with this particular family, to listen to him speak about how the church, First Lutheran Church, had found its way into this quite particular form of service and relationship. As probably most of you know, Mr. Lenikoff and his family began attending the Lutheran Church, First Lutheran Church, some years ago. In the 1880s, he had worked for the KGB in the Soviet Union. Not 1880? He's younger than I thought. 1980s. Yeah, sorry about that. That, of course, raises in my mind my brother-in-law, a man now of blessed memory, who was married to my eldest sister, who worked for the RCMP in I Division, in intelligence. So he would be my personal case to parallel with this. Or anybody working for CSIS these days, or the CIA. So along with his family, he'd been in Canada for over 12 years, when his application for permanent residency was caught up in the new rules associated with the War on Terror. So First Lutheran offered Mr. Lenikoff sanctuary when the Canadian Border Services Agency decided to deport him. And he's lived there since Tuesday, June 2nd, 2009. Reverend Richard Hergesheimer is the pastor of First Lutheran Church, and he befriended the family. He has served the church for quite a number of years, actually. He has venerable Missouri Synod roots, I have discovered.
But I got therapy.
But he got substantial therapy and serves in the ELCIC church. So I'm delighted you're here, and thank you for coming. We look forward to engaging you.
Before we begin, I want to express my thanks to the Chester Ronning Institute for the Study of Religion and Public Life for their kind invitation for me to come and speak to you. Having an opportunity to share the story of the congregation I serve as we were led, pushed, shoved, and pulled, sometimes kicking and screaming by the Holy Spirit into new for us and fresh for us and challenging for us and to us an understanding of what it means to be a church and the church in sanctuary. Having the opportunity to tell that story is a happy privilege. And I'm grateful to Mr. David Goa, the director of the Institute, for asking me to put this presentation together and thereby compel me to do some theological reflection. Always an unexpected pleasure for parish pastors who rarely have time to fill that particular part of the job description. David, you made me set aside the time. And whether anybody else likes what I have to say, I'm grateful for what you've done, and I'm content with what I have done. I'm going to make reference in there to this article from the Canada Lutheran, the magazine of the Lutheran Church, and an article that David Goa wrote in there. Now, I had never seen David Goa, didn't have a clue what he looked like, and we had talked briefly on the phone, and then when I saw his picture, I immediately thought he's an Orthodox monk who lives in one of those monasteries way up in the rocks in Greece or wherever. And then I thought, maybe he's homeless. Mikhail Lenikov said, no, he's right out of Lord of the Rings. I thought, that's better. That's better. The word sanctuary comes from the Latin sanctus, which means holy. Sanctuary thus refers to a holy place, and while it is most often used to describe a place where God dwells, the term is also applied to a place that is considered untouchable, that's safe, meaning that it should not be harmed, such as a wildlife sanctuary and a bird sanctuary. People who take refuge in a sanctuary are also, or at least should be, safe and protected from harm. There are various understandings of the church's sanctuary, and I'm going to start out with the broadest one. About 8 years ago, First Lutheran Church entered into the process of becoming a Reconciling in Christ congregation, which is a community that defines itself as welcoming gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered persons into full participation in the life of the congregation. As you can imagine, quite naturally, there was some debate about why we are doing this, particularly why we're singling out gay members for welcome, instead of just saying, we welcome everyone, which I suspect some people would agree is really code language for we welcome everyone who is like us, who thinks and acts and believes and behaves like we do. And so there were questions raised in our discussions that took the form of those famous words in the Small Catechism, what does this mean? That is, what does this mean in terms of the risks? What are the advantages? And of course the question, what does the Bible say? What does the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada say? And perhaps more important than anything else, what will my friends or family members in other congregations in Vancouver say about us or think about me? We decided not to take a vote on the issue of becoming RIC, Reconciling in Christ, but we rather elected to poll or survey the congregation. And we made that decision to avoid dividing the congregation by requiring people to take an either or position, for or against, which happens to be characteristic of the political realm as outlined by David Goa in his recent article in the Canada Lutheran, where he contrasted the political sphere, which forces people to take a stand on a particular issue and thereby divides them by binding people to positions which seek the defeat of the opponent, of the other. In the realm of the kingdom, he says, the calling of the church is to find common ground and to build bridges between people, to be religious. That is, in its root words, religio, which means re-tying, reconnecting, realigning, or rebinding people together, either despite our differences or because of them. By the way, that reference to David's article is a good example of what we might call sucking up to the sponsor of this event. Anyway, the results of the survey found that 80% of those who responded were in favor of welcoming gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered persons. Now, that did not mean that all 80% were in favor of embracing or celebrating or even endorsing same-gender relationships, marriages, sexual practices, gay pride parades, or even more contentious, the ordination of gay and lesbian clergy. The overwhelming percentage simply reflected the wishes of the parish to no longer exclude or check on the sexual preferences or practices of those who wanted to be part of our community life. Interestingly enough, First Lutheran, as do all congregations, I suspect, already had homosexuals as members, but none came out publicly, either before or after the survey. They did, however, mention to me privately how glad and grateful they were to be part of a church where it would be safe to be gay. Although by their refusal to come out of the closet, it was clear that they weren't entirely convinced that this congregation, their congregation, was safe. and that their friends in it would open their arms in welcome to those who either by choice or circumstance had been compelled to live a lie, either denying who and what they are, or forced to pretend to be something other than what they were. Their statement and their actions, or non-actions, helped me and others recognize the reality that for many, and maybe even most, gay and lesbian Christians, that the church is not a safe place. It's not a sanctuary, but is rather a place of danger, of risk and fear, because of the threat of being outed, and the subsequent exclusion, marginalization, humiliation, and rejection that they would suffer from family and friends, from church members, and perhaps most reprehensibly of all, from their pastors. And so, in the concept of the church's sanctuary, to declare a congregation's willingness to welcome all, means to be prepared to become or be a safe place for those who are out of the ordinary in terms of sexuality and the expression of sexuality in intimate relationships. That was about 8 years ago. About 7 years ago, we sponsored a refugee family under Canadian Lutheran World Relief's Women at Risk program. This single mother and her four children had spent 10 years in a refugee camp in Tanzania after fleeing the Rwandan massacre. And it wasn't long until after their arrival that others from the same region in Africa came to church with them. And we began to hear stories from them which drove home the point that this congregation was a safe place for these newcomers. And at its most basic, to be safe meant that they no longer needed to be afraid of getting raped by men in the camps, or arrested, or assaulted, or shot by police or rebels. In addition, their children would be able to go to school and have the same normal, regular, ordinary life that Canadian children enjoy. Now, to be the church and sanctuary meant that it was to be a safe place to be black, to be poor, to be illiterate, and socially unsophisticated. It's an interesting side note here. Many of our members of African descent had huge difficulties with First Lutheran welcoming homosexual persons. That was understandable, given the fact that they had come out of a cultural and religious background in which homosexuality was a grave sin, an offense against church and state, punishable by public shaming, imprisonment, or in some cases even execution. Nevertheless, their conviction that the church should be safe for them was an unsettling contrast to my way of thinking, when the result is that the church is a sanctuary only for some, but not others, which in reality at least compromises or completely eliminates the whole idea of the church as sanctuary if it's not safe for everyone. About 6 years ago, Bishop Ray Schultz came to First Lutheran to help us work through the process of determining our congregation core values. And as part of the evening's discussion, one of the values mentioned somewhat frequently was to provide a safe place for members. I must confess, I wasn't exactly sure what that meant. But with Ray's prompting, the definition or understanding which arose seemed to imply a community or a place where people could be who they were without fear of embarrassment or judgment, where they could cry or laugh, be social or not, to be themselves. In other words, now the term sanctuary had to do with the freedom to be honest, to be authentic, congruent, a word that means the inside and the outside fit together, where what you see is what you get. It meant to be a congregation where we didn't have to pretend to be someone we were not, or feel like we were the only ones who had weaknesses or failings or flaws. Since that time, I've come to believe that other than 12-step groups, churches may be, or at least can be, one of the few places left in our society where people can admit their brokenness. And it's refreshingly honest to be able to be refreshingly honest. Let me make it very specific. All of us here tonight know what we are like. We all know that sometimes we are selfish and self-centered, that we are ungrateful and stubborn, that we are sometimes scared of dying and sometimes scared of living. We all know that there are times where we feel so lonely and empty that our hearts almost break with sadness, and that sometimes we hurt so much inside we can barely pull ourselves up to take another step. We also know that we are occasionally riddled with insecurities and shot through with self-doubts, leading us to feel that if others knew us the way we really are on the inside, that they wouldn't like us anymore. We also know that all of us live with regrets and remorse over things we've done that we shouldn't have done, and over things we've not done that we wished we had. Furthermore, we know that none of us has loved God the way we ought to or even wanted to, and neither have we loved our neighbors the way we planned to or promised ourselves we would. And to top it all off, we know that on our own and by ourselves, we're never going to get any better at doing either or both. And how do we know that about each other? It's really very simple. Week in and week out, we confess all that stuff publicly, in places like this, in front of God and everybody. And curiously enough, that confession of our sins, that admission of our failures and hypocrisy, that acknowledgement of our brokenness and woundedness is a marvelous, liberating, and life-giving gift, because we don't have to pretend any longer. We don't have to lie anymore, not to God, not to each other, and not to ourselves. Instead, we are free to be who and what we are, simply humans. Not superhuman, not subhuman, just human beings who believe that we are loved and accepted just as we are, as the flawed and glorious human beings we are. Try walking into Starbucks tomorrow morning and saying this out loud. Anybody here agree with me? We are in bondage to sin and cannot free ourselves. We have not loved God or our neighbors as we ought. Forgive us, heal us, and help us amend our sinful lives. Do that and see what happens. To you, to those drinking their caramel macchiatos, and those waiting in line to announce their pretentious orders. Do that, say that, ask that, and it will become pretty obvious pretty quickly that despite the air of intimacy and conviviality that Starbucks attempts to create and market, that it is not a safe place to be and admit who and what we are as human beings. As the old phrase goes, in my vocation, in the ministry, sincerity is everything. Once you can fake that, you've got it made. Seeing and being the church's sanctuary is, on our best days, seeing and being a place where, in good Lutheran language, it is safe to be both sinner and saint at one and the same time, where there's no need to pretend to have it all together, and where we can trust the one who knows us even better than we know ourselves, where this unnamed one who can see into the secret places of our hearts, past all the walls and barriers we've set up around us to protect us from such insight, where this one who knows all about us and not only accepts us as we are and sets us free to be who we are, but even more astonishingly, takes up residence inside us and thereby makes us holy and whole. That is truly a safe place. About 5 years ago, a gay couple came to church because they had heard that First Lutheran was a safe place. That is, safe to be what they were, two gay men in love, who could and would sit next to each other in the liturgy, eat together at the Lord's table, enjoy the company of others at coffee hour, and not have to pose at being roommates who were merely sharing the cost of a house. It was interesting. They eventually got married, not by me and not at our church. And the Sunday after they got married on a Friday. We put it in the bulletin, congratulations to Kim and Randall on their wedding. We had them in the prayers, and we had a fairly new member in the congregation that particular Sunday who was sitting just down the bench from Kim and Randall. He didn't know they were gay. He didn't know who they were, and he had some serious objections to homosexual people. And he read in the bulletin, well, Kim and Randall got married, and Kim's a pretty gender-neutral name. And they noticed that Kim was the reader that Sunday. Isn't that nice? She's going to be reading. Turned out a gender-neutral name was not a gender-neutral person. And he was quite shocked when he went up to read. But he didn't leave. He kept coming, and they have become good friends since then. He still has his objections, but they have become friends. Church as sanctuary for Kim and Randall meant that it was safe to be who they are as sexual beings, as husbands, as Christians, as sinners and saints, and to be all those things while being brothers in Christ with others who had either minor or major concerns or issues, but who were doing their best to be welcoming and inviting. 3 years ago, Mikhail Lenikoff, his wife and son, showed up at First Lutheran Church. And over the course of the next year, the understanding of church as sanctuary took on entirely different dimensions and took us to a different level of understanding and action. In her book, The Door is Open, Glimpses of Hospitality in the Kingdom of God, Deborah Feguth gives an excellent and concise summary of the history of sanctuary. The concept of sanctuary as a place where people can be protected from the law dates back to the Hebrew Scriptures. In Deuteronomy 19, under God's orders, Moses set aside three cities as refuge for individuals who accidentally killed someone, to prevent the dead person's family from seeking vengeance in the heat of the moment by means of what we call today an honor killing. The point was to prevent the shedding of innocent blood. By about 600 of the Common Era, sanctuary was a legal right in England and Scotland. Only this time it wasn't cities, but Christian churches that were set aside. The Visigothic laws produced in about 650 provided protection for those who sought sanctuary and asked the clergy to insure them from injury, at least, and to negotiate their pardon, at most. The practice of providing sanctuary in churches continued for the next 1,000 years. The most notable and famous exception to that principle and practice being the murder of Archbishop Thomas à Becket in the cathedral at Canterbury in 1170, by soldiers sent unwittingly, of course, by Henry II, the king, who wanted Thomas dead, who underwent a public lashing as a demonstration of public penance for his violation of the sanctity of the church. Even though the legal right to sanctuary was removed in 1623, political authorities continued to honor it as a moral right. The modern idea of sanctuary, Feguth continues, has been used throughout North America since the 1980s, usually as a means of providing refuge for someone who is in danger of being deported back to a land where they are sure to be persecuted or killed. For example, in the early 80s, thousands of people were flooding illegally into the United States from El Salvador and Guatemala to escape government death squads. American authorities dealt with these asylum seekers by sending them back, often to certain execution, until a Presbyterian church in Tucson, Arizona, declared itself a sanctuary in 1982. The stand taken by Southside Presbyterian turned into a movement, and soon churches all over the U.S. began opening their doors to people who feared for their lives if they were sent back to Central America. In the 1990s, sanctuary became fairly common in Europe, especially in the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Germany, where dozens of churches took in refugees, most often Kurdish people, fleeing persecution in Turkey. In Canada, we cherish human rights, including the right to sanctuary. Perhaps part of the reason for that is because we were horrified when Archbishop Oscar Romero was gunned down in 1980 while celebrating Mass in the Cathedral of San Salvador after speaking out on behalf of El Salvador's poor. We were also sickened to hear and read about the Rwandans massacred in their church buildings where they had fled to escape the genocide that was raging through the country in the spring of 94. Figueth continues, seeing the very places that were supposed to provide safety being burned to the ground while people were trapped inside them was more than most people, Christian or not, could stomach. For the most part, she says, since sanctuary is a last-ditch effort after all other avenues have been exhausted, Canadian churches and leaders making it available think long and hard before they agree to grant it. It is, after all, a form of civil disobedience to harbor someone who has been declared illegal in the country and ordered deported or expelled. Now, while police in other countries have gone into churches to remove people who have sought sanctuary, Canadian government officials and law enforcement officers have, with one exception in 2005, respected the tradition of sanctuary, even though it remains and they retain the legal right to enter a church to remove someone in sanctuary. Figueth contends, and I agree with her, that dozens of people's lives have been saved as a result of the church's defiance of the law. And we believe, and we hope, that one of them who will be spared is Mikhail Lenikov, who has been living in sanctuary since June 1st, 2009, 28 months and 9 seasons ago. See, when Mikhail took sanctuary in First Lutheran, it wasn't a random choice made by somebody haphazardly knocking on church doors. First Lutheran is where they had been welcomed into the congregation almost a year earlier. Mikhail, his wife Irina, and their 6-year-old son Dimitri moved to Vancouver in 1997, entering the country on a student visa so that Mikhail could earn an MA in Japanese literature at UBC. Following the completion of his master's program, he was invited to begin a PhD program, and it was then, in late 1999, that he decided Canada would be a better place for his family to live than Russia. And so he applied for permanent residency status. And it was then that he volunteered the information that he had worked for the KGB, the Russian Secret Service, for 6 years back in the late 80s. He had been recruited by the KGB during university because of his fluency in the Japanese language, an especially desirable skill since Vladivostok, where he grew up, lived, and went to university, is just across the water from Japan, an economic superpower. Now, there are those who have accused Mikhail of withholding that particular bit of information when he came to Canada. But the truth is, he had not provided it earlier simply because the student visa application never required it. He gave me a little example about that, and this is a little sidetrack. He said, if you enter a country and you answer all the questions at the border and you have a white handkerchief in your pocket, but they don't ask you if you have a white handkerchief in your pocket, you don't volunteer that information because you don't think it's important. Later on, when you're there, you go to buy a car and they ask you all kinds of questions and they say, by the way, do you have a white handkerchief in your pocket? And you say, well, yes, I do, as a matter of fact. Oh, now you're in big trouble. You should have mentioned that at the border. It doesn't seem to be important. When he came as a student, it wasn't asked for. When he applied for status, it was asked for, and he said it. And ironically, it was because he told the truth voluntarily about his service in the KGB that he was later cited as a security risk, and his application for permanent residency status was eventually rejected. Little history lesson. Both before and after the collapse of the old Soviet Union, Russia required of its citizens that they hold an internal passport. But to get an internal passport, which would allow citizens to move around within the country, find or change employment, and receive medical care, everyone needed a permanent Russian address. Unfortunately, the Lenikovs had sold their apartment in Vladivostok when they needed money to support themselves going to graduate school in Canada. However, even more troublesome is the fact that because they lived outside of Russia, when the Soviet Union collapsed and Russia became what it is now, they were unable to exchange their old Soviet internal passports for the new ones of the Russian Federation. This means that even if Mikhail was to return to Russia now, even apart from being deported there, he wouldn't have the proper documentation necessary as a citizen to move around the country, find a place to live, get a job, or have access to medical care. In other words, in the very best case scenario, without the new internal passport, Mikhail would end up living in a legal limbo for years before he, if ever, gets adequately documented in Russia. In addition, his case is further complicated by his voluntary admission that he had been a member of the KGB. Because, you see, after making his application for status, he was interviewed quite extensively by CSIS, Canada's Security and Intelligence Service, and he was cleared by them of any suspicion of being a spy in Canada. However, the final judgment made on his case, which was made by one person, which initially seemed to be positive because of the results of the CSIS investigation, the ruling was eventually made to reject his application. But there was an opportunity to appeal that ruling and have it overturned, and a successful appeal seemed favorable. But then something far more dramatic and devastating intervened for Mikhail and countless others, the terrorist attacks of 9/11. As all of us know very well, as a result of that tragic event, everything related to national security was ratcheted up unbelievably. Although Mr. Lenikov had lived in Canada for 3 years as a law-abiding resident of Canada, Canadian immigration officials now became very suspicious of his past affiliation with the KGB, going so far as to accuse him of being a sleeper agent. If he is, he's the worst sleeper agent in the world. And everybody knows where he lives, what he does, and what's he going to report on? What Lutherans do? So, while the initial reason for rejecting his application was because he was considered a threat to the security of Canada, he was and is now determined to be inadmissible to Canada on the grounds that long-standing immigration legislation prohibits Canada from accepting as residents anyone who worked for agencies or organizations that engaged in subversive acts against democratically elected governments. That's right out of the legislation. Now, while I understand, to some degree, the background and purpose of that law, I must confess to some puzzlement regarding the interpretation of it, especially since the same thing could easily be said about the CIA, which overthrew democratically elected governments in Central and South America, Chile among them, in order to either restore or put into place strong leaders better attuned to American interests. And I doubt very much if a former member of the CIA would have her or his application to live in Canada rejected. It's even more difficult to believe that the present Pope would not be welcomed into Canada with open arms if he were to apply for a permanent residency status, even though he was once a member of the Hitler Youth. Forgive me for that snide bit of sarcasm. Because beyond the mechanics of the internal passport issue and the non-threat he poses to Canada's security, we are convinced that Mikhail has a well-grounded fear that if deported back to Russia, he will be in significant danger of being persecuted and prosecuted. As he put it, people who work in security services need material in order to justify their jobs. And as a former KGB officer, 15 years away from the country, I am the perfect material on which to build an espionage case. After all, collaborating with an intelligence agency of a Western country is tantamount to treason. And given the publicity around his admission that he was KGB and he was interviewed, debriefed by CSIS, it is entirely reasonable to conclude that his return to Russia would be hazardous to his health, particularly these days, when the most powerful man in Russia is none other than Vladimir Putin, the former head of the KGB. The entire Lenikov family was battling deportation when they walked into First Lutheran one Sunday morning in the late summer of 2008. They weren't looking for sanctuary when they began attending, and they didn't come for help with their political dilemma. Instead, they came for the same reason anybody else comes to a congregation: to find a place called home, a community to which they and we can belong. But I want you to listen to Mikhail tell his own story about sanctuary in his own words. We had originally hoped to have a Skype interview where you could talk to him, but the mechanics, the technology was difficult, so he's recorded a DVD. As you can see and hear, Mikhail is not inclined to put a tearjerker together to tell his story in a way that would have people reaching for the Kleenex box. He is steady, stable, controlled in terms of his moods. He keeps his emotions up and down in close check. When I first looked at the DVD he put together, I wondered why he was intent on showing the sanctuary and all the furnishings, the table, the organ pipes, the tree, the fountain. When I asked my wife why she thought he did that, she replied, "Well, duh, it's his home. And when people come to our house to visit, we like to show them where we live." In other words, the worship space, what Lutherans call the sanctuary, is the heart of his sanctuary, the centerpiece of his physical home. It is also spiritually, emotionally, and psychologically the heart of his hope. A little piece of heaven, he calls it. See, Mikhail doesn't get to look to the future very often, in part because focusing on the future, especially an unknown one such as his, steals whatever goodness and gladness exists in the present. In the same way, while he doesn't review his past or the past decisions very often, because, in the words of the famous hockey player, it is what it is, and the past can't be changed, it is appropriate to ask the question, does he regret his involvement in the KGB? Of course he does. The decisions he made as a young man 35 years ago have caused significant pain and heartache to many, reopening a lot of painful old wounds. And not least of all, his wife and son are suffering the consequences of his actions. And it's never easy to watch someone you love suffer for something that isn't their responsibility. So, would he love to turn the clock back and undo what he did and what he was? Of course he would. But nobody gets to do that. The only thing he can do, and I believe it is the driving force behind the new person he has become, the only thing he can do is do his best to make up for the past by living differently in the present. Living more generously, thoughtfully, gratefully, mercifully, showing a profound acceptance and understanding of those who, like me and others, wrestle with our own demons and carry our own burdens from the past, and sometimes need somebody to listen to our stories and then speak to us the same word of grace he has heard from us, the assurance that our God is a God of second chances. A God of new beginnings, a God of fresh starts. One final response to his video. It was intriguing to me that he used the movie The Truman Show as the prevailing metaphor for the sanctuary story, because his life, all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly, his life is in the public domain. available to any and all at any time to view or review, to dissect, and to judge. Frankly, I'm not sure very many of us would appreciate or be comfortable having our lives, past and present, put under such close scrutiny. Furthermore, he's not only the central character in the movie, he's also an observer of it. He's watching his own life unfold. He has no power, no control, no influence whatsoever over his destiny, over what people he has never met or even talked to in Ottawa or anywhere else will decide will happen to him or to his family. Instead, he can only watch and wait and hope. Somebody asked Gandhi in the middle of his nonviolent revolt against Britain whether or not he was optimistic about the outcome. He said, "No, I'm not optimistic, but I am hopeful." Hope, not wishful thinking. Hope is what keeps all of us going, even when we're not sure we can and or even want to go on. Some implications from the church's sanctuary. Coming close to the end, thank you. Granting refuge as a biblical or ecclesiastical or theological imperative. Jesus says in Matthew 25, "Whatever you do to the least of these, you do to me." I'm not referring to the old WWJD, what would Jesus do, but rather, what would we do to Jesus? What would we do for Jesus? What would we do with Jesus? I was hungry, thirsty, naked, in prison, a stranger, and you took me in. What should we, as Christians and as Christian communities, do for someone, for Christ, who knocks on the door and asks, "Can I stay here?" Do we turn him away with those infamous words, "No room, no room"? I think he's already heard those once. In the case of Mikhail, the knock on the door was quite literal, but more often it's figurative, metaphorical, theological. We say that we believe Jesus comes and is in Mikhail and in every person who cries out for help. But do we really? And if so, what does that mean for us? What does it mean to us? Now, I recognize that it is impossible to take Jesus' words, "the least of these," as literally true in every case, which is why reflection and thought, care and attention and prayer need to be present and accounted for. And yet, Matthew 25 has something quite literal in its hermeneutic, the word that talks about interpretation and application, meaning that at the very least we are compelled to take Jesus' words seriously. "Whatever you do to the least of these, you do to me." Let me give you an example. When I went to our parish council and asked them whether we should grant Mikhail's request for sanctuary, the answer was unanimous. "Of course we will, because it's the right thing to do." Now, I am fully aware that the phrase, "it is the right thing to do," can sound arrogant and even morally pompous. And yet, in looking back over what we did and what has happened to us and through us over the 3 years since we met Mikhail, it is clear that one of the primary lessons we learned through this whole affair is that knowing the right thing to do isn't very hard. Doing it is hard. And the reason it's difficult to do the right thing is because we're not at all sure we want to do it. And so we dance around our notion of what is right, doing our best to avoid doing what is right, claiming, for instance, that we don't have enough information to make the decision, or we're not sure where it's going to lead, what others are going to think of us, how much it's going to cost us down the road in terms of money or commitment or compassion or church members. And so it's sometimes more convenient, less frightening, and a lot less risky to not do what we know to be right than it is to take the plunge into the unknown, and as Nike says, just do it. Take the example of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran scholar and a Lutheran theologian par excellence, who, while reading some verses in Romans that said, "Be obedient to the authorities," chose to go against the Lutheran state church in its fawning adoration of Der Führer, and instead, knowing full well that he was violating a Lutheran doctrine and a biblical teaching, chose to oppose the authority of his state as well, by allying himself with those who attempted to assassinate Hitler. I'm sure that Bonhoeffer was well aware that either course of action, doing nothing or doing something, was tainted with the stink of self-justification and would therefore require forgiveness. And so, with considerable fear and trembling, it seems to me he decided to ask for forgiveness for a sin of commission, rather than ask for forgiveness for a sin of omission. Doing something rather than doing nothing. Let me tell you, nobody's motives are pure, no matter whether we think they are or not. Instead, in humility, we are bold to make the decision to do what we believe to be right, and then we throw ourselves on the mercy of the court, trusting that it is no longer we who live, but Christ who lives in us, and Christ who acts through us, and Christ who stands by us, and Christ who is for us. A second implication of the church's sanctuary, making a life and death difference. Through the events of the last 18 years at First Lutheran, and more specifically over the past 8 years, and even more particularly the last 3 years, I have come to learn that opening oneself and one's community to being a safe place is filled with risk and with indescribable joy. And the risk is that it changes us forever. And the joy is that it brings meaning and purpose and fulfillment to our life and our faith. About a year ago, I was at an installation of a pastor in Vancouver. And at the reception afterwards, a couple came to me in their late 50s. They've been supporters of McHale, even have sent money. And they came to ask me, was there anything different, any other news? And we talked for a while. And they said, you know, we've been members of the Lutheran Church our whole lives, and we've never done anything really important, anything that made a difference to life or death. And I had this overwhelming sadness come over me to think that the church, which has as its treasure a message of life overcoming death, a message of abundant life in the face of death, how sad it is that the church spends so much time and energy and talent on trivialities, on ecclesiastical and institutional busy work, when there is such a marvelous opportunity awaiting us to make a difference, a life and death difference, by providing sanctuary to those in need of a safe place. Not just to someone who's gay, not a refugee, not necessarily, or even someone about to be deported, but to make a difference by providing a sanctuary for any and all who want and need to be human. Simply human. Fully human. Whole and free and risk-taking human beings created in the image of God and bearing the image of Christ. What a gift that is, to be able to do that. What a prize awaits us. Finally, I want to shift gears and look very briefly at the issue of the church in the public square, the very thing I was supposed to talk about at the beginning of this. We've all heard the old phrase, two wrongs don't make a right. But it's true that three lefts do. When it comes to church as sanctuary, in terms of granting sanctuary, sometimes doing something wrong, according to the law, is the right thing to do according to the gospel, to ethics, to scripture. In the same way, when it comes to what is legal and illegal, doing what is legally right, according to the law, can be ethically or biblically wrong. We must obey God rather than human beings, is Peter's response to those in authority who demand that he stop preaching. And we have countless examples from our own time to look at. Jews in Germany, Tutsis in Rwanda, Bosnian Muslims in Serbia, a whole raft of ethnic and religious cleansings which remind us again and again of the question, is it ethical, permissible, God-pleasing, to break the law in order to protect someone's life? And I suspect that most of us, maybe even all of us, would agree that the answer is absolutely, without a doubt. Following up in the same vein then, does the church have the right and the duty to challenge the government and others in authority when the church believes that what the state is doing is ethically and biblically wrong, even though it may be legal? Stories told of two Greek philosophers. One of them is sitting on the steps of the king's palace eating a bowl of lentil soup. The other one comes out of the king's palace where he's just had a meeting with the king, and he comes over to the first and says, "You know, if you'd learned to be nice to the king, you wouldn't have to eat lentil soup." And the first replies, "If you'd learned to like lentil soup, you wouldn't have to be nice to the king." Perhaps the time has come once again for the church to look once more to the example set by the prophets of early Judaism, who fearlessly and sometimes fearfully challenged the political and religious authorities of their day. Ready or not, the time has come for us to speak out against the hypocrisy, ideology, injustice, and falsehoods propagated in the name of national security. When Christians, individually or together, become too intent on protecting our assets, and preserving whatever vestiges of privilege or prestige that we have left, or privilege or prestige that have been given to us to keep us quiet, whenever we allow our voices and consciences to be muted or stilled by threats or bribes, we forego our heritage and we betray our mandate. Let me show you an article in the Vancouver Sun. It came out 2 days ago. I don't know if it was in that. The Ukrainian group hires investigator to watch former KGB officer taking asylum in church. It's from the Ukrainian Canadian Civil Liberties Association. They've hired an investigating firm, I don't know, to sit outside the church and see if Mikhail comes out, and if they are there, then they maybe make a citizen's arrest, take him to the police, where then he would be deported. So he doesn't go outside anymore to pick vegetables in the church garden. And the reason I bring it up is because one of my greatest critics and fiercest detractors shortly after Mikhail moved in was a man, I won't mention his name, but he's a retired professor of history at the Military College in Kingston, Ontario, and he's a very big push in the Ukrainian Canadian Civil Liberties Association. We spoke on the phone, and he said, "You know, I'm sure the founder of your church would be rolling over in his grave knowing what you've done, giving sanctuary." Every so often, you know, your education comes in handy. And out of nowhere popped the thing. Actually, I said, "You know, the founder of the Lutheran Church spent 2 years in sanctuary, put there by his protector to protect him from the command of the emperor, who said Luther was an outlaw and could be killed." So I said, "We have good bloodlines when it comes to sanctuary." He said, "It doesn't matter," he said. "Your irrelevant and insignificant little church isn't going to make a difference." I agreed with him about that, being an irrelevant, insignificant little church. And it is precisely our irrelevance and unimportance, our insignificance, that enables us to take the risk of making our voices heard. We have nothing left to lose. I mean, when one is significant, not even worth noticing. You can't get more insignificant. It can't get worse. And in terms of standing up to and standing up against the powers that be, it can't get any better. Therefore, creating places of sanctuary, of safety, of true security, of peacefulness, harmony, collegiality, equality, diversity, new beginnings, and a readiness to follow and imitate Christ wherever he leads, that is our calling. That is the cost and the joy and the power of discipleship. To sum it all up, were we right in granting sanctuary to Mikhail Enikoff? We can never be certain of that, especially since, as the theologian Douglas John Hall says when he writes, the opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is certainty. The conviction that one is certain, absolutely right, is always dangerous. So, were we right in granting sanctuary to Mikhail Enikoff? We can never be certain of that. For as Sheila Whitaker, a high-powered business executive, said in an interview, decisiveness is not the same as being certain. I am often decisive. I am seldom certain. So, were we right in granting sanctuary to Mikhail Enikoff? We can never be certain of that. But we did it anyway. And I hope and pray that we will always seek to do what we believe to be right. Let me quote once more from David Goa's article. During times of political debate, he wrote, I invite you to ask the Amish question. What will this political act or policy do to my community? We always choose our neighbor, those we admit to our community, and if we have faith, we will choose those considered by the natural community to be an enemy, an outsider. That's why the stance of faith knows no political allegiance. With that in mind, let me conclude with a phrase from one of our Eucharistic prayers, which goes like this. We give thanks to you, O God, not as we ought, but as we are able. We do our best to create sanctuaries, safe places, perhaps not as often or as wonderful or as adventurous or as encompassing as we might, but we do what we do as we are able to do it, so that we and others and all can be and behave and struggle and strive and live and love as whole and free and welcoming people who are God's own people. Let me close in the words of one more, far, far more famous and influential than I. Here we stand. We can do no other. God help us. Thank you.